Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Hello and welcome to the RTC Weekly Download. I'm Jim Dolan, your host for today's show. Well, I think we're going to play something well-known and then two things that are not so well-known. We'll start off with the well-known Sam Spade. This is called The Queen Bee Caper. It's from 1949.
By transcription, The Adventures of Sam Spade, Detective, brought to you by Wild Root Cream Oil Hair Tonic, the non-alcoholic hair tonic that contains lanolin. Wild Root Cream Oil, again and again, the choice of men and women and children, too.
Sweetheart.
Sam, where have you been?
I've been tasting the bitter with the sweet at Miss Wigginson's School for Girls, sort of a special course in homicidal apiculture.
Apiculture?
Mm-hmm.
There were apes involved?
Effie, where is your Latin? Apis, apianus, of or pertaining to bees?
Oh, bees, of course. It was a bee caper?
It was a beekeeper caper.
Oh, that's funny, Sam. That's the honey.
Effie, put these words down in your little book. Honey, sweetness, hives, combs, etc. Never mention them again.
What?
Keep things humming, sweetheart, and I'll be right down to drone my way through my report on the queen bee caper.
Dashiell Hammett, America's leading detective fiction writer and creator of Sam Spade, the hard-boiled private eye, and William Spear, radio's outstanding producer-director of mystery and crime drama, join their talents to make your hair stand on end with The Adventures of Sam Spade. Presented by the makers of Wild Root Cream Oil for the hair. You know, during the summer, when you spend so much of your time out of doors, it's important to pay special attention to the care of your hair. To keep it right in place, to help keep it from getting dry, use America's favorite hair tonic, Wild Root Cream Oil. Wild Root Cream Oil grooms your hair neatly and naturally, relieves dryness, and removes loose, ugly dandruff. Use it every day. If you've never tried it, ask for it in the 25-cent Get Acquainted bottle, and ask for it by name. Wild Root Cream Oil Hair Tonic. Again and again, the choice of men and women and children, too. And now, with Howard Duff starring as Spade, Wild Root brings to the air the greatest private detective of them all in The Adventures of Sam Spade.
To be or not to be, hum.
Oh, hello, Sam. Hiya, Sam. How's tricks?
Oh, Effie, really, this jargon, this patois. Don't you think it's about time we spoke like educated people?
You know best, Sam.
Every time I visit one of our institutions of learning, I find out something I didn't know.
Oh, Sam, that's incredulous. Well, you just know everything.
Yeah, I guess I do when you come right down to it. The bee, for instance. Bees are a genus of insects of the Hymenopterous order.
The what?
Hymenopterous. Living in society is composed of one queen, or perfect female, a few males, or drones, and an indefinite number of undeveloped females, or neuters, which are the workers.
That's me, I suppose. A neuter.
Well, that's for you to say.
Of course.
And you know what else about the bee?
What, Sam?
Confidentially, it stings. July 10th, 1949... To Miss Elizabeth Cowley, Miss Wigginson School for Girls, Seacliff Drive, San Francisco. I wonder about girls sometimes. And that's bad, Effie. Bad.
Oh.
From Samuel Spade, license number 137596. Subject, the Queen Bee Caper. Dear Miss Cowley. I was singing a medley of sorority drinking songs as I opened the wrought iron gate, walked up the garden path past those cast iron deer, and presented myself at the big brass bell pull beside that massive paneled door that stands guard between the outside world and your sheltered inmates. A little housemaid wearing dimity let me in and led me to your office. I sat on your chintz-covered sofa and looked at your drapes with their thriving beehive motif and waited for you with my back half turned to the open door. Yeah, hello, how are you?
All right, girls, break it up now. Go on. Haven't you ever seen a man before? Run along now, you'll be late for physical ed. Go on, quick.
Miss Cowley?
No, I'm not Miss Cowley.
Oh, no, of course not. No, I was just hoping.
You're Mr. Spade, aren't you? Glory Thomas, I'm Miss Cowley's assistant.
Nice day, yes.
Mm-hmm. Don't bother to move. I'll lean over you. Put this report on her desk.
Oh, sure.
Miss Cowley will be here in just a minute.
Oh, thanks. So warm in here.
Next time, wear a mailman's uniform and a 50-year-old stoop. You'll find the temperature's exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, yes, ma'am.
See that you do, then. Oh, Glory. There seems to have been a misplacement of some of the hockey. Would you check on it, please?
Oh, surely. Nice to meet you, Mr. Spade.
I'm Elizabeth Cowley. You may sit down.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Spade, I'll be painfully frank with you. A thief is at large in my school.
Oh? Well, you probably have a good answer, but I'll ask it anyway. Why not call in the police?
I have a good answer, Mr. Spade. My girls come from San Francisco's finest and wealthiest families.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Wigginson's has had an untarnished reputation for more than three generations.
I'm sure.
As headmistress, I must handle this matter with the utmost discretion. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I already know the thief. Are there any questions?
Well, only one timid one. Who is it?
I regret to say a faculty member is to blame. Glory Thomas. She was in here a minute or two ago.
Oh, really? Well, why, Miss Thomas, you find any of the loot stashed away in her room?
Well, no. No, not exactly. I haven't recovered any of the stolen articles, but I'm sure Glory's responsible. I'm certain she's the thief.
You're just sure?
I thought perhaps you might establish definite proof against Glory.
You mean you want me to frame her?
Oh, no, Mr. Spade, you misunderstand me.
I don't think so, Miss Cowley.
Oh, dear, I was afraid this would happen. I told Ursula, but then I...
All right, I'll ask. Who's Ursula?
Mr. Spade, I think I can trust you. It was Ursula who instructed me to call you. Ursula Cavanaugh. You know the name.
The Ursula Cavanaugh, inherited all the real estate, lives in Cavanaugh Towers penthouse, hasn't set foot out of there in 20 years?
Yes. Mrs. Cavanaugh is our school's benefactress. She is, of course, on the board of trustees. She is, moreover, a dear personal friend.
Oh, I see.
Oh, yes. We were classmates together here many years ago. Ursula's quite unlike myself. Married well, though a widow now. Rather aggressive. Frankly, she wishes to have Glory Thomas discharged. But her connection with the dismissal must not be known. Now, I don't suppose I can ask you to take the assignment now.
I'm a detective, Miss Cowley, not a frame-up artist. I had to have my name called up in the lobby, and then two elevator trips later, I faced her on her penthouse terrace. Ursula Cavanaugh looked like a 1910 stock company lead out of Charlie's Aunt, smoking a black Italian stogie and gripping a cane like a shillelagh. Two men were on the receiving end of her black snake whip of a tongue. A youngish guy, stockbroker type, and an individual in a morning coat who looked practically nude without a butterfly net.
Oh, you're a fool and a nincompoop, Jelinek. I lost all patience with you ages ago. Not only are you incompetent, but you're also dishonest. Don't mind telling you that when the board of directors meets on Thursday, I intend to instruct them...
Really,
to have...
Miss Cavanaugh, I've tried not to discommode you in any way. I endeavor in every detail to fulfill my responsibilities as manager of this...
Don't
hotel.
Interrupt me.
Auntie, I think you've got Jelinek and me all wrong. Now, the truth is,
Gerald, you're both a pair of thieving scoundrels. Now, get out, Jelinek, before your weasel face ruins my digestion.
Very well, madam. I remain at your service.
No backbone, no spunk. And as for you, my dear nephew...
I think I'll toddle along, Addie. I ought to get back to the office.
Control your little impulses, Gerald. I admire a little larceny in any man, but not at my expense.
I was beginning to think I'd become invisible in that rarefied penthouse atmosphere. She hadn't even blinked at me while Jelinek slunk back to the lobby and Gerald toddled along to his office. The terrace was a riot of bloom. I don't know much about flowers, but she must have had them all there. Off to one side, a little man in a blue smock putted around a wooden structure on a stand. I'd become aware of bees humming amidst the flowers when she finally spoke to me.
You're Tom Spade, aren't you?
Sam, ma'am, the fun-loving Spade.
Picked your photograph out of the other detectives. Looked like you got spunk. Why'd you come here?
Curiosity. I met Glory Thomas out at Miss Wigginson's. I liked her. I wanted to see the type that would strong-arm her out of a job from a safe distance.
Spunky. Come over here, Mr. Spade. I want to show you something. Piggott.
Yes, ma'am.
That'll do for now. Work at the other end of the garden for the time being.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, Piggott, my gardener and beekeeper. Most taciturn individual. You know what this is?
Well, I didn't, but now I can see it's a beehive.
Yes, my own beehive. Fresh honey from a tea and fruitcake every afternoon.
Fine old tradition.
Observe this hive, young man. Honeybees are the most intelligent of all insects, surpassing even the ants. And why? Because one female controls a community of many, many thousands.
I am against it.
Yes, Mr. Spade. The queen bee reigns supreme. The males are drones, quite useless. The female workers perform all necessary labor. No waste motion. No dissension.
Well, some of my best friends are drones, and I just can't stand them.
I think you understand me, Mr. Spade. I wish Gloria Thomas removed from San Francisco for an excellent reason. My nephew, Gerald Long, the young man who just left here, has developed absurd romantic notions about her.
Yeah, so you want the romance busted up, but if you try to break it up openly, your nephew might get stubborn and even marry her. On the other hand, by framing her as a thief, you ward off the affair until you can figure out some other dirty trick.
I knew you'd understand me, Mr. Spade. I admire bluntness in moderation. Well, what do you say to joining forces with me?
Just one thing, Mrs. Cavanaugh. Nuts. Next morning, I put through a call to Nickinson School for Girls. It had been my intent to talk to you, Miss Colley, to tell you I'd left my hat in your office, but somehow I found myself talking to Glory Thomas. And somehow our talk resulted in a cocktail date at the 10 o'clock Scholar Bar and Lounge.
I shouldn't have come, of course.
Oh, exam papers to grade, no doubt?
Stacks and stacks.
Soft velvet-type hands. Well, what's this on them?
Stain. I teach our girls chemistry, among other things.
How about me taking on a night school class for the other things?
You're crazy. You don't need any education.
Well, I can always use a postgraduate course.
You're really crazy, Sam. I needed this.
We'll make a night of it.
Maybe.
Gerald won't object, huh?
What's that mean? Who have you been talking to, that hateful old woman?
Mrs. Cavanaugh wants to put the boots to you, Glory. She called me in to frame you.
I could kill her.
Oh, easy now, Glory.
Don't talk to me. I thought I could take it. I thought I could be patient and wait while Jerry ironed everything out. But not now, though. I hate that selfish, domineering old woman. I hate her nephew, and I hate you.
Well, that'll do to start with, honey. Now let's go down my list. I hate...
Oh, let me go. I've had all I can take for one night.
Wait a minute, Glory. Hey, you forgot your bag. Hey! She disappeared around the corner as I came out into the street. It was starting to rain. As I stepped off the curb, I slipped and turned my ankle. As I limped onto Montgomery Street, I saw her disappearing into one of the tall buildings on my side of the street. It could have been the Cavanaugh Towers. I step and a half into the lobby thereof a few minutes later. As I came in, Jelinek, the manager, was getting off the elevator. He swatted himself several times in the neck and then went into a door marked private. No trace of Glory in the lobby. I looked in the bar. She wasn't there, but Albert Piggott, the beekeeper, was having a stinger.
Oop. Now I'm beginning to feel good. Hey, who's this? I know that. Why, it's Mr. Spade. Sit down, Mr. Spade.
I don't have time just now, Mr. Piggott. Tell me.
Sit down.
Easy.
I'm fired. Have you heard? I'm fired. Just a worker out of work. Turned out by the queen bee.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Piggott. I imagine Mrs. Cavanaugh wasn't too easy to work for.
I told her to keep away from the bees when I wasn't there. Well, she's gone and disobeyed me. One of the workers must have stung her. She's got a temper, you know. Ooh, my. Must have smashed the eye with her stick. Bees were everywhere, all over. And then she fired me.
Oh, when was this and why did she fire you?
Oh, about just now, maybe half an hour ago. I knocked and then there wasn't any answer and then I let myself in. It was all dark. I couldn't even see her. Heard the bees, of course, but couldn't... Who was I? And I said, Mrs. Cavanaugh, you disobeyed me. And in this voice, this awful voice, she said, Mr. Pickett, you're fired. Get out. This awful voice in the dark. And Mr. Pickett, mind you, never before, just Pickett this and Pickett that. And hey, where are you going? Hey!
I didn't bother to stop at the desk to get myself announced. I took the passenger elevator and then operated the penthouse elevator myself. No hands. Nobody answered my ring. The door was unlocked. I went inside. Crossed through the empty apartment to the terrace. The rain had just stopped and the sunset cut a sudden shaft. First I heard it. The humming of swarming bees. Then I saw the overturned beehive. Then I saw Ursula Cavanaugh sprawled back in her chair, her stick and Italian stogie on the floor, while the bees clustered greedily over the fruit cake and honey set out on the table. I wondered if those most intelligent of all insects had the answer to Shakespeare's question, O death, where is thy sting?
The makers of Wild Root Cream Oil are presenting the weekly Sunday adventure of Dashiell Hammett's famous private detective, Sam Spade. Here's important news on good grooming. If you want the well-groomed look that helps you get ahead socially and on the job, listen. Recently, thousands of people from coast to coast who bought Wild Root Cream Oil for the first time were asked, how does Wild Root Cream Oil compare with the hair tonic you previously used? The results were amazing. Better than 4 out of 5 who replied said they preferred Wild Root Cream Oil. Remember, non-alcoholic Wild Root Cream Oil contains lanolin. It grooms the hair naturally, relieves dryness, and removes loose, ugly dandruff. So if you want your hair to be more attractive than ever before, get the generous new 25-cent size of Wild Root Cream Oil, America's leading hair tonic, on sale at all drug and toilet goods counters. It's also available in larger economy bottles and the handy new tube. By the way, smart girls use Wild Root Cream Oil, too, and mothers say it's grand for training children's hair. Get Wild Root Cream Oil. Again and again, the choice of men and women and children, too. And now, back to the Queen Bee Caper. Tonight's adventure with Sam Spade.
Sam Spade.
Oh, yes. You shouldn't have gone to see Mrs. Cavanaugh.
I didn't make any promises, ma'am.
Ursula was quite upset by your visit. Called me after you left her. Quite angry about it, Mr. Spade.
Oh?
She wanted to see me today. Our weekly half-day holiday, you know. But I simply couldn't face her. I'm sorry if I sound... I finally managed to doze off after everyone left for the afternoon. Have you called before?
No, this is the first time. I'm at Mrs. Cavanaugh's place right now.
Indeed. Does Ursula wish to talk to me?
She can't.
I beg your pardon?
It might be a good idea if you'd come over here, Miss Collie. Mrs. Cavanaugh's dead.
What was that?
Mrs. Cavanaugh's dead. And since you're her oldest and closest friend...
Yes, Mrs. Spade. I'll come immediately.
Well, you came on over, Miss Collie, but meanwhile, nephew Gerald Long arrived, also Pickett, whom I called down at the bar and who sobered up with remarkable rapidity on hearing the news. Gerald was shaken up by his great aunt's demise. We waited for the family doctor to arrive and watched Pickett entice the bees back into the hive. You turned up soon after and tried to soothe Gerald's nerves. The hotel manager, Jelinek, also flooded in. The doctor diagnosed cause of death as shock from formic acid. The secretion bees inject into the bloodstream with their stingers. We all stood around thinking our various thoughts as the doc voiced this verdict. Piggott was the one who voiced an epitaph.
She really knew nothing about bees, you know. The queen bee was all important, she thought. But there's always a rebel in every hive. The queen bee is always deposed sooner or later. The worker bees go on. But the queen bee can't reign forever.
After that, we all left and went our various ways. Poor old Piggott shouldn't have said that. And he must have been a lot drunker than he seemed. Because he was found next morning in his garden in Marin County beside his overturned beehive, a victim like his late employer of fatal bee stings.
Don't make you a fool if you think you'll get away with this.
Don't threaten me, Mr. Long. I've been bullied long enough. I don't intend to lose my position here now Mrs. Kavanaugh's gone. I've taken all I could stand from her, and I don't intend to let you walk all over me.
I'll do whatever I think needs to be done, Jelinek. Well, if you're trying to insinuate
I
that I have
I can cause you as much trouble as you cause me. Maybe more. With what I found out about you now.
Get out of
I
here. Go on, beat it before I break.
How did you get in here, Spade?
Door was open.
Well, if you're here to collect any kind of bill, I want to know what services you rendered.
Nothing's rendered yet. But I figured you might like to know that Aunt Ursula was murdered.
Murdered? You can't say that. Not my hotel.
Shut up, Jelinek. You need proof to back that up, Spade.
I've got it. Piggott.
What? Piggott's dead.
How do you know?
His doctor just called me.
Yeah. Well, that's why I know your aunt was murdered. I've just been out to Marin. I had quite a session with that doctor.
Well, where's your proof, man? Who'd want to kill her?
Well, Oh, stop it. Practically everybody who knew her.
Really, now, I must protest this disrespect to the members of the...
Shut up! Go on, Spade, go on. Start getting specific.
Well, specifically, Piggott's doctor, because of what I suggested, examined the dead man again, found the mark of a hypodermic, plus the fact that a concentrated solution of formic acid killed Piggott. Piggott's next-door neighbor said he'd been stung as often as 10 and 12 times a day. That meant he'd build up a certain immunization to bee sting.
Are you suggesting that someone murdered him with an injection of commercial formic acid?
I thought I'd made that fairly clear.
And what would the motive be?
To keep him from talking about his employer's murder.
I see. Well, is that all?
Yeah, except that his neighbor told me somebody answering your description called on him this afternoon.
Mike. Oh. Well, yes, but Spade, look here. I can explain
Allow
that.
Allow me. Hello.
Gerald, hello, darling. I'll be through in about an hour. I just got to check supplies in the chem lab, and then I'll be home and show you what a cook I am. You better be brave.
I'm sorry, just a second. Here's Gerald. For you, Gerald, your wife.
Oh, hold on a second, honey. Spade, look here now. You can't drag her into this thing.
When did you get married?
Yesterday afternoon.
Husband and wife. No testifying, huh? Well, I don't think I'll need your testimony. Jelinek's face fell 4 inches into his ascot tie as he heard himself lose exclusive hush money rights to the above information. Pausing only to enjoy a hearty laugh at his discomfiture, I went on to my next and final port of call, Miss Wigginson's School for Girls. This time, there was no girlish tittering as I entered Miss Collie. No dewy young Amazons clutching hockey sticks in their grubby little hands. For a very good reason, as you told me.
My girls are dismissed for the day, Mr. Spade. Because of poor Ursula, of course. Really disrupts our routine. First our weekly half-day holiday yesterday, and now today...
Yeah, I'd like to talk to Miss Thomas in the chemistry lab she is, I think.
Very well. I'll take you to her. She knows nothing of our first meeting.
I've talked to her.
Oh, well... In here.
Yes? Oh. What do you want?
Thought we might talk.
We've nothing to talk about.
Well, we could talk about this hypodermic.
Put that down. I'm using it for an experiment.
Or, how about a formula? HCOOH or CH2O2?
What? That's formic acid.
Mm-hmm. Miss Collie, you said yesterday was a half-day holiday. Did Miss Thomas stay here in school?
Why, no. She rarely does on Wednesday afternoon.
That's why Mrs. Kavanaugh had a visitor. Didn't she, Glory?
Did she?
After you ran away from me?
All right. I did go up to see her. I was so mad about what you told me. I intended to hand in my resignation and give her a piece of my mind, and I... But she was dead when I got there.
Oh, Glory.
No. And I just got panic-stricken and ran.
Yeah, murder's a pretty scary thing.
Murder? What do you mean, Mr. Spade?
Mrs. Cavanaugh died from a hypodose of formic acid. Somebody familiar with chemistry would use that method.
Then that could mean...
Mm-hmm. The acid could be made up in this lab. The hypodermic could be this one here.
I didn't kill her. I didn't.
You say you were scared. You were so scared you ran all the way to City Hall and married her nephew.
So you found out?
Jellyneck found out first. He intended to squeal the old lady, but she was dead when he got back. He knew her will disinherited Gerald if he married without her auntie's approval while she was still alive.
We married after she was dead. But that didn't matter. After I saw you, I told Jerry if he was any sort of man, he'd marry me, will or no will. He did.
And yet this morning, he drove over to Marin County to see old Piggott.
You think he was trying to shield me? I tell you, she was dead when I got into that room. I don't know anything about Piggott.
One moment. I believe I recall that Mr. Piggott said Ursula spoke to him when she discharged him. Glory, you must be mistaken about the time you entered that room. She couldn't have already been dead because...
Yes, she could have and was. The killer was almost caught by Piggott. She hid behind the curtain in the dark and spoke to him. Miss Cavanaugh was already dead, but...
I see. Mr. Piggott thought it was Ursula's voice, but it was yours, Glory.
No, it was yours, Miss Collie.
What?
You committed both murders. You had access to the murder weapon. You had the half-day holiday to do it in.
Mr. Spade...
Even at that moment, the finishing school schoolmarm had to say, Mr. Piggott.
Well, I'm not sorry for it. Ursula misused her power shamefully.
And now the queen bee's deposed again.
Oh, you're brighter than most men, Mr. Spade. You, too, understood the significance of Mr. Piggott's remark last night.
Yeah, I could have been a little brighter a little sooner. You helped give yourself away when you asked me if I'd called you earlier yesterday afternoon.
Why, Sam? How could she?
Well, Cavanaugh bullied her since childhood. Then you came on the staff and your ability scared her. The queen bee being deposed and whatnot. When Cavanaugh wanted you framed, she saw a chance to get rid of both of you. She hoped her murder would look like an accident, but if it was recognized as murder, you'd be the logical suspect.
Oh, you're much too clever, Mr. Spade. Let's get it over with.
Yeah, let's. It's up to those drones at Homicide from here on in. Period and a report.
Sam?
Yes, Evie?
How come Gerald went out to see Mr. Piggott?
Well, Gerald didn't care about the will, but he didn't want to boot a fortune out the window either. Glory hadn't told him she'd seen his aunt, so he called on Piggott to find out when Piggott last saw Auntie alive. Go type that up. I am completely well, and when you return, we shall Indian wrestle.
Certainly, Sam.
And now, listen to this. Shopping notes. Tonight or tomorrow, get a family-sized bottle or handy tube of Wild Root Cream Oil, America's favorite hair tonic.
From July 10th, 1945, that's Sam Spade and the Queen Bee Caper. And I hope you enjoyed those Wild Root ads and those puns, especially the ones at the beginning of the program. Again, get everything having to do with bees and honey and all the rest of it in there. That's quite interesting. I think these people had a lot of fun writing this show every week, and we certainly do have a lot of fun listening to them even after all these years. They're still pretty good. Well, at the beginning of the program, I did mention that we're going to have some programs that are a little bit less familiar to you. We'll start off with one of those right now. This is a kind of a filler in radio, a short program, I think somewhere around 15 minutes, I think, and it's called Adventures in Research, and it's about today's secret weapon. This is from March 9th of 1943.
Adventures in Research. In a land where peace is prized, what is more reassuring than the man in uniform, be it the policeman or the soldier? And one of the most important pieces of equipment either one uses was once yesterday's secret weapon. This is Paul Shannon bringing you another transcribed story of science produced as a public service in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. And today telling you of yesterday's secret weapon. As far back as one can dip into the history of nations, they have had a common aim, the ancient Greek ruler Dionysius, in the year 430 B.C., expressed it this way.
We must needs invent a weapon for protection, whereby the power of one man can be increased beyond the capacity of his ordinary arm.
And so Dionysius invented a weapon which he called Polybolus, a weapon which projected a succession of arrows supplied by a magazine or hopper. In the years to follow Dionysius, this purpose remained the same, to increase the power of the individual. At the Battle of Hastings, some of the English archers used bows which fired two or more arrows simultaneously. And with the invention of gunpowder, an idea was born in the mind of a German monk named Bernard Schwartz.
I cannot banish from my mind, Franz, the writings of the Englishman Bacon.
Ah, I have seen you reading what he has written, and you have wrinkled your brow as one who is deep in thought.
I have been, for as I read of this gunpowder that the Englishman writes of, strange visions scurried through my mind.
Visions?
Yes, of iron tubes for men who now carry bows. No longer will they carry those bows, but instead long iron tubes with strange arrows padded to fit into this tube.
Oh, strange thoughts you think, Bernard.
And in this tube is this gunpowder of which Bacon has written. The gunpowder packed in the tube discharges the arrows.
And the arrows are propelled through space?
It is a haunting vision, for Bacon's writings have seriously aroused me. For if I can see such strange devices, what will the mind of man invent that is even more strange, more awesome?
It was not long before such a device was invented. The French had a name for it, orgue, which is to say organ, and it did resemble a pipe organ, with its 6 to 10 barrels mounted side by side on a frame. They were fired by a single lock, firing a quick match, which ignited the charge of all barrels in rapid succession. These weapons the French called not only orgue, but also ribald de cœur, which means, of all things, little bit of laughter. But from medieval France, our picture changes to America, which in the year 1862 was in the throes of a civil war. And to the War Department, Dr. Richard J. Gatling of Chicago, an inventor by trade, paid an important call.
But, Dr. Gatling, the machine gun is nothing new or novel.
I realize that, sir, but...
And all of them have had one thing in common. Yes, every machine gun that you inventors have tracked to my office. All had one thing in common.
But my idea is a radical change.
All the same, Doctor. None of them work.
If you will but listen, General, I'm sure I can explain the theory of my gun to you.
Oh, in theory, it undoubtedly is perfect, but in action...
Let me explain. The gun consists of 6 barrels, fixed in a circular form around a central axis. Behind the 6 barrels is the loading mechanism. The cartridges are fed into the top barrel by a trough at the top of the mechanism. As the gun is fired, the cartridges fall into the top gun of their own weight. Then, as the operator turns the handle, the entire axis revolves. While the gun at the top is being loaded, the gun at the bottom is being fired and ejects the empty cartridge as it moves up to the top, and so on.
And when the gun explodes from the heat?
No, sir. The entire gun is covered by a water jacket which cools the barrel.
Excuse me, Doctor, but though I'm certain your gun would undoubtedly show a great amount of effort and inventiveness, we're in the middle of a war, and we have no time to spend in searching out new gadgets.
I realize that, sir, but if I can't convince the War Department officially, would there be any objection to my using your soldiers to demonstrate just what this weapon can do?
Well, Dr. Gatling, such demonstrations, all unofficial, of course, might be most agreeable to the War Department.
Of course, unofficial.
Yes.
One of my employees could operate the gun in action, showing the men in the field just how this machine gun operates in action.
Man, oh, man. Won't that give him to him, Bo?
Oh, I never thought I'd see anything like that. Boy,
If we had two more of them things, well, they could send most of us home.
Ain't that so? I never saw any gun like that one. Why, this Gatling fellow...
Ah, man, don't you know? That there's no gun. It's a gat.
The newspapers in the North carried no details about the Gatling gun. In fact, it was merely referred to as the unofficial secret weapon. Thus, the Gatling gun's reputation never crossed the Atlantic. Europe was concentrating on problems of its own, the Franco-Prussian War. And newspaper correspondents there began hinting of a dark secret, too.
It is reliably reported that the mighty army of Napoleon III has a secret weapon which will disperse the ranks of the Prussians. Although only a few soldiers have been permitted to see it, it is reported that it is the discovery of a Belgian officer who some 20 years ago invented this new and fearsome device.
Never was a secret kept so dark and so hidden. False rumors were planted to confuse any Prussian eavesdroppers. For indeed, the secret weapon of France was a machine gun, invented quite independently of Dr. Gatling's. On mobilization day in July 1870, the French moved their new guns to the front, wrapped in tarpaulins and heavily guarded by armed soldiers. It was quite a secret, although some newspapers had uncovered the story and hastily revealed it to their readers.
The mighty secret weapon of the French army is a gun that fires 12 times per minute. The device weighs 1,800 kilograms and loads 2,100 cartridges. The gun itself is used in artillery fashion to supplement the long siege guns, invented in 1859 by a gun.
But actually, this did not give the secret away. For the French, in an absent-minded moment, had shown the Prussian staff officers just how it worked during maneuvers some years previous. But that was not the only mistake the French generals had made. Their almost fatal error was in classifying the machine gun as artillery. And the Prussian generals could well remark.
The range of their weapon is limited to that of the Chassepot rifle, such as French infantry uses. A range of, 1,000 yards. Perhaps a little more. So their secret weapon gives us a target that is even more attractive than their field gun. Even more. For our guns cannot range it. And their little secret weapon cannot reply. A secret weapon.
But the French newspapers continued their enthusiasm.
The mighty, wonderful weapon is a tremendous advance in France's military history. The great secret weapon of the Emperor's army will bring a speedy victory over the Prussian force.
But as the Prussian armies made further and further inroads, the fate of the machine gun, the wonder weapon, seemed well marked, even to the French.
The weapon is more of a liability than an asset. It is stupid to believe that an infantry rifle, even if mounted on wheels in series, can perform the task of artillery.
The high command of the Prussian army has proved that the machine gun as an armed weapon is a failure, bringing complete discredit on those responsible for its use. The machine gun is not an effective instrument of war.
And so Prussia and France, two of the greater powers, believed that the machine gun was a complete failure. Nevertheless, Queen Victoria's England became curious about the wonder weapon with the tremendous firepower.
After extensive tests before the House of Commons, the War Office believes that this is a superior weapon. Although many years have elapsed since the American Gatling invented the machine gun, no one has yet improved upon it, nor have we seen a single performance of any machine that matches it.
In 1882, however, came a new name and a new chapter in the history of the machine gun. The name... Hiram Maxim.
In 1881, I visited an electrical exhibition in Paris and was made a Chevalier of the Legion of Honor on account of some electrical and chemical work that I had done. Well, a while later, I came upon an American I had known in the States.
Well, Maxim, Hiram, good to see you again.
Well, hello, hello. I haven't seen you in years.
Yeah, been a long time. But I've been keeping up with you in the papers.
No?
Yeah, saw you mentioned about a year ago. I said to my wife, hey, old Hiram's been decorated by the French and kissed on the cheek for his work in electricity and chemistry.
Yes, yes, but you know you can't live on
it. Yes, I know. Lots of honor, but no money, huh? Well, you listen to me. If you want to make a pile of money, invent something you can pick up with your hands and say, I invented this. Something you can put a patent on. Well, something like a stove or a chair or, well, at these times, like a gun.
Well, that made me think of the time when I was only about 14 years old. I was making drawings for my father of a hand-worked machine gun. I also thought of the powerful kick I got the first time I fired a United States military rifle. So, on my way from Paris, I made a drawing of an automatic rifle. Within a few weeks, I had set up residence in London and started an experimental shop at 570 Hampton Garden.
Although Maxim's first thoughts were of a repeating rifle to be fired from the shoulder, he soon evolved the machine gun to fire from a tripod, and he worked with tremendous energy and speed.
Patent 3493, registered July 16, 1883, being an invention of improvements on machine or battery guns and in cartridges for the same and other firearms. Patent 6063, January 3, 1884. Patent 7844, February 23rd. Patent 9407, May 23rd.
What made Maxim's machine gun so revolutionary was its many automatic features. Maxim produced a self-loading and self-ejecting single-barrel gun. The principle was simple. The gun barrel, after firing, recoiled in its mountings. This pulled a string, which snapped the barrel back into firing position again. The movement backwards and forwards operated the mechanism, which, having fired the bullet, ejected the empty cartridge and loaded another in its place in the chamber. The cartridges were held in clips in a belt, which the action of the gun moved through the feed block from right to left. The result? A Maxim machine gun, the basis for all such rapid-fire weapons now in use. And while it is best known as a weapon of death and destruction, still, it is an essential instrument in the hands of those who would maintain law and order and peace in a troubled world. Part of the good and evil that came from Richard Gatling's and Hiram Maxim's Adventure in Research. And that's today's Adventures in Research, produced in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. Programs are broadcast to armed forces personnel overseas through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Join us again next week for another transcribed story of science on Adventures in Research.
Adventures in Research from 1943 and yesterday's Secret Weapon. We have another 15 minutes on hand, and it's going to be used to play some kids programming, or actually a kids program. This one is Hop Harrigan. He's fighting World War II still. Long time. And this is from 1942, from December 1942. It's called The Nazi Bribe.
Presenting Hop Harrigan, America's ace of the airwaves.
CX-4 calling control tower. CX-4 calling control tower. Standing by.
Control tower back to CX-4. Wind southeast. Ceiling 1200. All clear.
Okay, this is Hop Harrigan coming in.
Boston girls, as you read your newspapers and listen on the air to thrilling tales about the daring exploits of American airmen in giant flying fortresses and liberators, lightning-fast Thunderbolts and P-38s, I'll bet you've wished many times that you were old enough to qualify for training as an Army or Navy flyer. Well, even though you may still be too young to join Uncle Sam's air services, you can prepare yourself for the fulfillment of that wish. That is, if you're a high school junior or senior, or between 16 and 18 years of age. How? Listen carefully. Pre-flight courses are now being established in high schools all over the country for air-minded students. These courses teach navigation, aerodynamics, meteorology, theory of flight, engine design and structure, all the necessary fundamentals. And what's more, you can take these courses as part of your regular high school curriculum during regular school hours. These courses, approved by the Army and Navy Air Corps and the Civilian Aeronautics Administration, will train American youth to take its place in aviation, America's strongest arm in war, and America's greatest career in peace. So get in the swim. Prepare to take your place in American peacetime aviation. Remember, if you're a high school junior or senior, or between the ages of 16 and 18, you are eligible to take these courses. Now, if some of our listeners are still too young for this special training, tell your older brothers and friends about the pre-flight training courses in high schools. I know they'll be interested. Tell them to find out at once if there are aviation courses already established in your high school. If not, ask your high school principal to include them in the curriculum for the next semester. Now, further information may be obtained by writing the United States Office of Education, Washington, D.C. But don't waste time. Careers are waiting for you in civilian and military aviation. America needs flyers. And now to our story. As you remember, Hop Harrigan, Tank Tinker, and Hop's Aunt Agatha were together in a hotel room in San Rio, a seaport on the west coast of Costa Rica, when a uniformed messenger arrived with a note for Hop. The note was signed by the commander of the Costa Rican Air Force and requested an immediate interview on a matter of great importance. Suspicious, because the handwriting in the note seemed to resemble German script, Hop instructed Tank and Aunt Agatha to follow him in a car in order to find out where the messenger was taking him. As we continue today, the gray car in which Hop and the messenger are riding is moving along the main highway at a fast clip. Following it, at a distance of a half mile, is the car with Tank at the wheel. Aunt Agatha is seated beside him. Suddenly, he glances up at the rear vision mirror and his eyes pop.
Jumping jennies.
What is it, Tank? What's the matter?
There's a car behind us. Turn around and get a good look at it. You see it?
Of course I see it.
Aunt Agatha, we're being followed. That car behind us is just like the gray one. We're trailing. They got us in the middle.
Oh, nonsense, Tank. Why should anyone be following us? We haven't done anything.
Oh, you don't understand. Hop was right. That note he got was a phony.
What's the note got to do with a car following us? If you can't talk sense, don't talk at all.
I'm talking sense. You just don't know how these Nazi agents work. They're not so dumb, not by a long shot.
Tank Tinker, what are you driving at?
Just this. Now, they sent that second car along, the one behind us, just to make sure Hop wasn't trailed to their hideout. We never even stopped to think of that, and so here we are, caught in the middle, getting the old squeeze play.
Well, after all, you don't have to stay in the middle getting squeezed, do you?
Where else are we going to go? If I step on the gas, we'll pull up to the car Hop's riding in and spoil his game. If we drop back, we'll lose him. Hey, wait a minute.
Now, what?
The car behind us is pulling up. The heat's on.
I don't feel any heat. What are you talking about?
Oh, I mean they're closing in on us. Oh, boy, are we in a spot. What'll I do? What'll I do?
Oh, stop mumbling to yourself. You're making me nervous.
I'm making you nervous. That's a hot one.
Oh, you're right, Tank. That car is coming closer.
Yeah, and fast, too. Well, there's only one thing we can do.
What?
Give it a run for its money. Hold tight. I'm going to shove the gas pedal down to the floor.
I thought you said
we can't help it if we overhaul, Hop. I'm not letting these monkeys catch me. Here we go.
Oh!
Hey, what was that?
Sounded like a backfire. Oh!
They backfire my eye. They're shooting at us. Keep down, down.
Oh, good heavens.
Get down, I said. Slide down on the floor.
But take the fall so dirty.
Take your choice, dirt or bullets.
Oh, I suppose you're right. Oh, what's going to happen to us, Hank?
I don't know. They seem to be shooting at the tires, trying to plug one. Hey, if we get a blowout, we're liable to turn over going this fast.
Well, then, for heaven's sake, slow down.
And let them nab us, nothing to it.
Oh, why did I ever get myself mixed up in this? Why didn't I leave well enough alone?
Well, Hop warned you. He told you there might be trouble. He said it was no job.
Oh.
I got it. It's a blowout.
Hank! Hank!
Can't stop her. We're heading for a tree. We're going to crash.
Yes?
Senor Harrigan is waiting.
Oh, send him in, please. Ah, Senor Harrigan, the pleasure is mine. Won't you come in?
Thank you.
Please be seated. A cigar, perhaps?
No, thank you.
Cigarette?
No, I don't smoke.
A very enviable virtue, to be sure. Well, I see you wasted no time responding to my request for an interview.
Are you General Juan Domingo?
No, I am not. Unfortunately, the general was suddenly called to Cartago. However, I am authorized to speak for him. We have been watching your career with a great deal of interest, Senor Harrigan.
When you say we, just who do you mean?
Who else but the government of Costa Rica?
You're quite sure about that?
That is a rather strange question.
Of course I am sure. You're quite sure that it isn't the German Luftwaffe, the Nazi Gestapo, that's been watching my career with a great deal of interest?
You are either a very clever or a very suspicious young man, Senor Harrigan. Or perhaps both. Undoubtedly, the Gestapo has been observing you. But that is no concern of mine.
I wonder.
What did you say?
I said, I wonder.
Then perhaps I had better put an end to your wonderment. Excuse me. Schroeder.
Yeah?
Schließe die Tür.
Jawohl, Herr Baron.
I have just given instructions for the door to be locked so we may discuss our business in privacy. There. It is done. We are alone, mein Herr. Now permit me to introduce myself. I am Baron Gustav Schiller, representing Herr Dr. Goebbels, Minister of Propaganda under the Third Reich.
Well, you seem quite proud of your connection.
I have every right to be proud of it. However, I do not propose to enter into a discussion with you as to the relative merits of your government or my own. I have not trailed you 7,000 miles for that.
What's that?
Yes, mein Herr. I have been following you for the past 6 weeks, ever since you succeeded in stealing a Messerschmitt plane from occupied France. Frankly, you have been a thorn in the side of the Third Reich. My orders are to remove you.
Well, I must say you're going about it in a peculiar way. Why waste all this energy? Phony notes, uniform messengers? I'm human. One bullet would do the trick.
No. No, that would be the wrong approach. It would make you a hero, a martyr. You are worth much more to us alive than dead. Since a great part of this war is being fought in the air, we are in need of something to develop our air arm. You, Herr Harrigan, have that something. The plastic plane.
Wow, this is all very interesting. Go on.
We are prepared to pay a high price for your services. I have with me $1 million in American currency.
$1 million? Boy, that's a lot of money.
It would make you independent for life.
Yes, I suppose it would. But what sort of life? The life of a traitor who put a knife in the back of his country and his people? Oh, no. We were stabbed once just about a year ago at Pearl Harbor. A lot of blood was spilled when your sneaking allies, the Japs, stabbed us in the back. We haven't forgotten that. No, not for a minute. The boys in the Solomons remember it. General MacArthur remembers it, and we won't forget it. Till you murderers have been taught a lesson for all time. You know, you have a funny idea that Americans can't hate. Well, maybe we take a long time building up to it. Maybe we are slow to kill. Maybe we don't like to take human life. But it can't be helped now. Words don't mean anything to you and your kind. Bullets are what count. And believe you me, you're going to get them day in and day out until you're down on your knees begging for mercy.
This is the last war we're ever going to fight, and this time we're winning it. For keeps.
A very pretty speech, mein Herr. Very pretty.
It wasn't meant to be pretty. Oh, you don't have to listen to me. You know what's happening. You know what our boys are doing in Africa and Guadalcanal, and yeah, your boss, Herr Goebbels, can tell you about our flying fortresses. How they're getting through to Germany every night of the week. Ah, you're frightened, that's the trouble. You're losing and you know it. This is the beginning of the end, and
that
from now
enough.
On...
Do you hear me?
There, you see? That's a sign. Frazzled nerves.
You have said too much, Harrigan. All I wish from you now is an answer to one question. Will you or will you not cooperate?
The answer is no.
That is unfortunate. Very unfortunate. Come.
Herr Baron?
Yeah, was ist?
Ein Mann und eine Frau haben ihn von einem Hotel gefolgt. Wir haben sie gefangen genommen. Sie sind in nachster Zimmer. Sie hätten ein Achseln gehabt, aber sie ist ziemlich gut.
Ah, sehr gut.
Das ist alles?
No, wait. Harrigan, I have just received some very interesting news. We are entertaining two of your friends, a man and a woman. The two who followed you from the hotel.
You're lying.
They are in the adjourning room. Their car crashed into a tree, but they suffered only minor injuries. Perhaps I can arrange something that will make you change your mind about cooperation with the Third Reich. Schroeder.
Ja, Herr Baron?
Look at your watch.
Ja, Herr Baron.
What time have you? Answer me in English.
2 minutes and 30 seconds before 5 o'clock.
That is correct. You will go into the next room where the man and woman are being kept, Schroeder. Precisely on the stroke of 5. Unless I give you orders to the contrary, you are to eliminate the man and the woman.
What? You wouldn't dare.
Lock the door on your way out. And remember, the stroke of 5.
Jawohl. Heil Hitler.
Heil Hitler. Harrigan, you have 2 minutes in which to change your mind. I will place the mantel clock on the desk so you can see it. And hear it. You have 2 short minutes.
Puzzled and uncertain, Hop's eyes shift from the clock to the German's face. He wonders if Tank and Aunt Agatha really are in the adjoining room, and if so, will Schiller carry out his threat to murder them in cold blood? Slowly the seconds pass, and the hour hand of the clock moves closer to 5. What will Hop do? What can he do? Don't miss tomorrow's thrilling episode. Same time, same station. Tune in and fly with Hop Harrigan, America's ace of the airwaves. And so we leave Hop Harrigan for today. But don't let another day go by until you find out for yourself all about the pre-flight training courses now being established in high schools all over the country. Remember, fellows, that this war, this terrific fight the United Nations are putting up to wipe out the Axis, is being fought by physically fit, well-trained young men. In modern warfare, training is all important. Toughness is essential. And youth, with these other two attributes, is necessary. It's never too early to prepare yourself, to make yourself physically fit, and to get as much training as you can for the demands of a career in the air age, either as an aviator in the air forces or as a commercial flyer after the war. Your school systems are taking steps to help you prepare yourselves for the demands of the air age. So take advantage of their aid. If you want further information about pre-flight training in high schools, write to the United States Office of Education, Washington, D.C. America needs flyers.
CX-4 calling control tower. CX-4 calling control tower. Standing by.
Control tower to CX-4. All clear.
Okay, this is Hop Harrigan taking off. See you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Hop Harrigan is a copyrighted feature appearing in All American Comics magazine.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.